today on Fearcast, I am your host, Spencer Fuller. This show is about fear is nothing gained, but motivation drives the soul. This episode is dedicated to Disney villain deaths as it affects the lifespan. With my guest, Ardiel Wessler from Spectrum News. He loves Disney and has a great spirit for California and local news stories. This one is no exception. Ardiel covered both Republican and Democratic conventions. He's an alumni of Tufts High School in Woodland Hills. Glad you're familiar with the area. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, pleasure to be here, Spencer. Thank you for having me.
Okay. In multiracial research, researchers examine racial and ethnic groups. This makes it important in understanding the cultural implications of Disney on children to emerging adulthood. Disney culture is important for lots of reasons, especially when introduced by your parents, let's say like at 2 years of age. Piaget had a theory how the cognition is learned, mimic, and stored memory based on exposure to the world. It brings a thought of parental control buttons on Netflix, for example. Should parents use this parental block control? It leaves questions for social psychologists to study over a person's experience with Disney from toddler to adulthood. What do you think, Ariel, about parental blockers on Disney films?
Well, you know, I think it obviously depends on the child. Everybody parents differently. Every child is different. But I think it's good. It's a good option for parents to have. I mean, growing up, some of my earliest images were from Disney movies, for sure. The Lion King, Aladdin, you know, the golden age of Disney, Beauty and the Beast. And so, especially with the villains, because they're you know, the facial expressions, and they're so dynamic and expressive that I think that sticks in a young child's mind. I mean, one of the images that I have in my mind that stays with me is the horrible scene from The Lion King when, you know, Mufasa is killed and he's dangling over the cliff there. And, you know, I'm in my 30s now, and that image stays with me.
I totally agree with you, and I am 29 years old, and I saw The Lion King when it came out in 1992 with my mom, and I don't remember all that about Scar and how gory and all that was, because there's always a happy ending from Disney, expectedly, but I think the dynamic that got kind of hard in The Lion King was that Scar was trying to take over Mufasa's, you know, reign, and he also kind of went on a binge and was, like, prowling around to get Simba.
Absolutely.
Yeah. On to the next point. In some ways, deception is a visual cue, which is what we discussed with the parental blockers, and that young children do not fully understand, according to Piaget stage 4, which is the formal operation stage. This is from adolescence to adulthood. This is where thinking is most concrete and looking beyond just the story holistically. Cognition is modified later as parents grant their children more privileges of seeing graphic content of the villains, including their demise. The concrete stage is where children can differentiate from the hero or the heroine from the villain in the Disney films. And this changes as you get older and start learning more from your friends and family and stuff like that. So, quoting a Disney film, Princess and the Frog, "Hey, you're in my world, not your world, and I got friends on the other side, Dr. Facilier." I saw The Princess and the Frog, and the villain, Dr. Facilier, is a voodoo witch doctor, and he basically has, like, all these magical powers to kind of, like, make it difficult for Tiana and the prince to be able to fall in love because he ends up losing all his money and all that stuff. All the stuff we take for granted, which is kind of relating Colbert's moral principles and stuff like that from my psych classes. And basically what happens to Dr. Facilier, he loses his powers and he gets dragged down into this grave, right?
Yeah, that's pretty pretty graphic.
Yeah, so his friends really weren't his friends, you know? Yeah, so that's like one thing I think parents are afraid of. Like, can we, you know, trust our friends that we meet in school? You know, like, how do you teach basic trust? You teach it from birth, so like the nurturing aspect. Would you agree with me?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, they always, people say that you're judged by the friends that you keep. And so I think, you know, if you put out a certain attitude or a personality, you attract those people who share that similar personality. And, you know, I would guess opposites attract as well. But I think as far as your friends that you're with day in and day out, you definitely build trust with them. I think that's a big part of it.
Well, with that in mind, parents are not even knowing that the psychology of death in films are like as Snow White when she is asleep from the witch's poison apple. The evil queen meets her death at the bottom of the cliff. She was driven with a self-fulfilling prophecy to be the fairest of them all. Does the message seem clear to how children should feel that beauty is not always the purest, or more is needed to reproduce as a species? As, well, looks mean and personality, which you happen to stipulate, and not having just looks being important, just like in The Little Mermaid, but we'll get to that in a bit. Mm-hmm. So what were your thoughts about the witch's death at the end from her, all of her competition with Snow White?
Well, her quest for beauty ended up taking its toll. I mean, I know the way that ends, you know, the dwarfs are chasing her and then lightning strikes the cliff and she falls. So another pretty graphic moment for kids to see. But I think it teaches, a good lesson that she wanted beauty at all costs. She pursued it. You don't really see Snow White. Snow White is the innocent person in this fairy tale. And I do think that it sends a message to kids that, you know, beauty is not everything. We've seen that in magazines and more companies that are starting to kind of back off on photoshopping women and creating this image that there's a perfect beauty out there that you know, young girls should, you know, try to achieve or young men need to achieve to, you know, to attract women. But it's usually on the female side, right? You don't see that too much with men, but it's usually corporate America that's going after young women to try to attract men, and then they put all the pressure on them to be beautiful no matter what, and to send this image from a young to send this idea from a young age for kids, I think that's troubling.
Most definitely. I'm sweating like a sinner in a church quoting Princess and the Frog. So now, the Hunchback of Notre Dame, Judge Frollo had a proclivity for Esmeralda and her body, which is considered sinful in the Catholic Church. I had an experience of visiting the site of Notre Dame in Paris in 2006, and It is quite gorgeous.
Yeah,
beautiful. And quite big. The only problem is just a personal story real quick. One of my friends, she decided to take a picture of a priest, and he was praying. I don't really know, like, how would you feel if someone's praying? Like, should it be, like, not displayed, or...
I think it depends on the religion and the person again overall, but yeah, I always have trouble taking pictures. I mean, in a church, if there's a, you know, if people are praying or there's a session going on or you know, a congregation is meeting, because it's kind of private. Everybody kind of wants to pray in their own regard, right? They don't want to be bothered. They just time between them and whoever they're praying to.
Yeah, the only reason I wanted to kind of stipulate that is because Judge Frollo, he kind of seems more against the gypsies and their faith, and seems more pagan-like, so like non-Catholic. But as far as trying to keep himself free from sin, he decides to fall into the hellfire at the end of the film, because Quasimodo and Esmeralda were trying to get away from him, and there's like this horrific song about like hellfire, and he talks about how he's conflicted, like he wants Esmeralda but he feels bad like at the same time, so he's almost like splitting himself, like what psychologists would say, like they're kind of feeling like a sort of dissonance, like if I do this, am I not pure, am I going to hell? So that leads to the point of the Hellfire song.
But that's pretty gruesome, I mean, as well. I was just watching a little bit before we went on air. I mean, he says, you know, quote, he shall smite the wicked and plunge them into a fiery pit. And then seconds later, you see him falling into that pit. Kind of, it's a little foreshadowing as to what's gonna happen there. But that's a pretty powerful image, too.
It's all related to human behavior. It does seemingly, just all around, Disney princesses are, like, the most desired thing for the princes. What is probably the prince that you felt the worst for, like, trying to save the damsel?
The prince that I felt the worst for?
Like, he did his best to save her.
Oh, that's a good one. Maybe Aladdin?
Really? Aladdin?
Well, I'm going back through my head here. I don't know. This is a toughie.
It might be Eric, because Ariel, she basically like loses her voice in order to basically seduce him to marry her. So she goes through about the same lengths. So they'd probably be like a really great...
Prince Eric. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that.
Okay. Well, in the scene where Ursula meets her demise at the point where the ship kind of just jabs her in the chest, because she was after King Trident's trident, and Ariel was doing her best to save her dad. And Eric, he has to steer this massive ship all by himself. No crew, nothing. He had no weapons.
That's true. He's by himself on rough seas with a huge Ursula that's just kind of growing out of the ocean. And he's on his own. That's very true.
Yeah, she causes deception as well. And I was kind of explaining deception. It can even just be like a persona, like the femme fatale, that girl with the black hair, that he ends up like trying to fall in love with her, but she forgot to change her voice because she loses the locket.
Yeah, very similar.
Yeah, so we're not making humor of death. Death is not always pretty. So definitely rent this movie if you haven't seen it. So I'm going on to my next topic. From a developmental psychologist's perspective, having the aging of the evil queen that gave her basic need of survival from Maslow's pyramid of hierarchical needs, her need to climb up to the last stage of killing Snow White, she did not reach self-actualization, and self-actualization is kind of just like your goal in life. So like her goal in life was to kind of off Snow White so she can be the fairest of them all.
Mm-hmm.
But since she happened to meet the bottom of the cliff with the really nasty birds that happened to scavenger and eat her, yeah, so I'm thinking it'd probably be about maybe age 7 for them to watch that.
Well, and it's interesting in that regard. You have to, because a lot of these Disney fairy tales, right, are even a little bit less dark than the original Grimm fairy tales that kind of Disney based all of these off of. This is a little bit more sanitized, but still full of imagery that could be disturbing to parents, depending on, you know, how comfortable their child is with certain types of media. And more importantly, these days, that's more important than ever, I think.
Yeah, just for the Disney princesses, for Ariel to want to give up her voice in order to get legs to go meet Eric, she basically has to kind of like sell her voice to Ursula, and she's sort of kind of like this madam, you know, almost like she's trying to kind of show her off to Eric, and hopefully she'll be able to, you know, romance
win
just,
him. Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely not a great mess. I mean, we heard, right, Keira Knightley recently was saying that she doesn't let her children watch with Cinderella or The Little Mermaid for that reason. She doesn't want them to get that idea that it's okay to, you know, give everything up for a man. That's a, you know, very modern ideal, I think.
Yeah, one of the other films I kind of just wanted to go over was Beauty and the Beast. And this film, I never really thought of it when I was a child.
It's one of my favorites.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, it kind of has a lot of to deal like with mental health issues. And I kind of just feel bad for Belle's dad because they mention the asylum a lot in this film. And the fact that Belle is kind of different and she's, like, into school and stuff, does that kind of seem like group pressure to kind of make her conform to how, you know, they see things in her town?
For sure. She has that whole scene where she's dancing through the, you know, the streets of the village, and it's very upbeat and positive. But if you think about it, they're all slamming her, like, you know, she's so peculiar, she's strange, what is she doing, she's odd, and she has to overcome all of that and be comfortable with herself. You know, she's always, her head's always in a book, and so I think there's a lot of pressure for that entire village is basically against her. She's the weirdo, she's the weird one, and I think you can draw a parallel, now that I'm thinking about this, to the Beast. You know, he's the odd man out, obviously, because of his looks. But she feels that as well, just emotionally, because of what everyone says about her. And so she's, even though she's beautiful, inside, I think she feels definitely like an outcast.
Yeah, for the Beast, in order to be cursed, he kind of was mean to this warlock or witch lady, and she ends up putting the curse on him. But I think it was more so kind of driven by his narcissism. His narcissism was so high that he basically had no compassion whatsoever, mm-hmm, for anyone but himself. And it kind of shows how the villagers kind of reacted to the beast, and they thought it was something terrifying. And usually, like, if you're a kid, you might see a beast and you might get scared and want to, you know, not have anything to do with him or go somewhere else.
Right. run the other way. But she sees the good, you know, she sees the good inside. But then I think also people I've heard, you know, can you chalk that up to Stockholm syndrome, which I think, you know, that you become fond of your captor, you know, and she's basically, he's holding her hostage in the castle. And so she, I think the feelings grow stronger. So you could ask from a mental health standpoint, you know, is that, does she really feel that way about him? Or because she's forced to live with him for so long, you know, do her feelings kind of change?
Well, Gaston tried to make a lot of advances for Belle.
Yes, nonstop.
Even tried to get rid of her dad in the same way. But Gaston, he ends up getting the mob, and they start marching through the village to the castle, and they start storming the place. Like, it's like really wild, really graphic scene, but very memorable. But as soon as he gets in there, the beast and him have a fight, and he kind of just falls off a cliff. And from that, I actually saw... I looked this up online. Mm-hmm. You can see skulls in his eyes.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm gonna have to watch that next time. Yeah. Although I'm noticing now that we're talking about this, a lot of Disney villains fall off of cliffs. That seems to be like the way to go, from high up, and they just kind of fall to their death, which is frightening.
Yeah. Do you think that he had a vanity issue, though? Do you
think Gaston? Kind of... Absolutely. Oh, yeah. I don't think there's any arguing he didn't. He's incredibly narcissistic. You know, that his whole song, I don't know if you've seen the musical, where he has a whole song called Me in the Beauty and the Beast musical, where he just talks about, you know, how amazing he is, and he's the best in the land. And absolutely, that clouds his judgment, and he doesn't want, you know, he feels he deserves Belle more than, you know, she should like me. He's like, absolutely, why wouldn't she like me? I'm amazing. I've got these muscles, and I'm this amazing guy. And and again, just like we saw with vanity in Snow White, you see this in Beauty and the Beast, where he would do anything to, you know, to not only get Belle, but to kill anybody that he thinks could be competition.
Yeah, I also kind of read in my research that Snow White was 14.
Yeah, it makes it a little more disturbing.
It kind of does, yeah. Well, I mean, because the film was like in the 30s, so I guess like in some sort of way that was sort of typical of the time, but that kind of brings to mind like the Victorian era, and kind of like how young girls, like as soon as they reach puberty, they're going to be married off. I don't think it's like that nowadays.
No.
Because it would scare a lot of dads.
Absolutely. They'd never let them watch any of these movies if I think they thought that was the main message getting across.
Do you have kids?
I don't. No, 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 no. No kids yet. I'd like to one day. And I'm in my head, I'm thinking about kind of the decisions that I would make as we talk about this. But I do have, I just became an uncle. So kind of excited to watch some of these movies with my niece. But I think more so now, I'm more willing to start with like the Pixar movies.
Because
I feel like that side of Disney, even the villains are a little bit softer. I think they're... One of my favorite Pixar movies is Ratatouille. I think it doesn't get a whole lot of love, but I really love that movie. And you've got the critic, you know, who's kind of this evil guy. He's the evil villain in Ratatouille, but he's not nearly as evil as, say, the Ursula or the Jafar or the Gaston. And I just think Pixar softens that a little bit. They do have these evil characters, but they're a little bit different.
Yeah, even just like with the main character in Ratatouille, the waiter who ends up kind of being controlled like a robot to be able to kind of make the best recipe in that competition and all that pressure. I just feel like Disney's kind of painting a bad picture of what it's going to be like to become an adult, even though I feel like those kind of images are for the adults watching it with their kids.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I think you bring up a good point. I think the Pixar movies kind of walk that line more than the early Disney animation movies, where they, I don't think Lion King is necessarily trying to appeal to adults as much as it is kids, but Pixar movies very much try to do that. Like, there are jokes in the way that, you know, the children will get, but the parents do. And so, yeah, I think you're right. I think there are some things that are in there for the adults that hopefully the kids don't get, or maybe, you know, maybe it won't paint the best picture for them.
Yeah, I also think for the Pixar films, and it kind of brings to mind, this film is called Brave, and Merida, she's Scottish, and the villain was kind of like this soul that was trapped in this bear, and to be able to release him, he gets tied up, and basically he does get killed, but his soul does move on, But there's just like this concept of death that brings terror to kids' minds and to, you know, adults. And you kind of don't really know how to have, you know, those conversations like with kids, you know, like death is inevitable. Like, what's a good time to bring that to their attention?
At what age? I think it's when the kids become curious about it. I mean, if you have a 3 or 4 year old that's asking you questions about death, I think you're honest with them, and you just find a way to go about it that means something to them. So whether that's, you know, maybe it's a pet or you know, a stuffed animal that they like, and you can explain, you know, what that means the best you can. But I think as soon as they ask, I think that means they're ready and they're thinking about it. So I don't think parents should put that off.
Yeah, that's why I kind of brought up multiracial research, because there's a lot of different like cultural customs, and there's like certain like thresholds that you have to reach in order to become an adult. So a lot of children, sometimes they reach adulthood at the age of 12 in some cultures. So like even then, they still might be told about death, or they might have like a certain like job or priority in their society that makes them need to learn about these certain issues. And there's like shamanism and all that sort of stuff that's like more anthropological though.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, just looking at these Disney deaths and kind of just like going through the lifespan, I just think it kind of might entice some fear in people. But I kind of wanted to talk about the different deaths in the Disney films, because I do think it could actually educate people more than trying to put those parental blockers on.
Absolutely. I think the blockers are just, it's like all or nothing. And people need to think about the why and the choices. You know, why are you having your child watch this movie? What do you hope they get out of it? And watch it with them, I think, in many cases. And if they have questions, you're right there. And I think it's more about the maturity of the child rather than a set age limit, or, you know, don't watch this movie until you're 11. I think it really, children are so different, and I think they develop differently. And so I think that's a very good point. You should wait and know your child, and then have the conversation that you feel is the most appropriate.
Most definitely. I also wanted to kind of bring to mind the proclivity for the gypsies. I didn't really explain that too much. The gypsies are kind of like, you know, they're fun, and they do non-secular dancing music. I just don't know how like that dynamic might affect more the Catholicism side of it, because it kind of makes them think of the devil, like, in their minds. I mean, do you feel differently about that?
No, that's...
Or the gypsy is just fun. It should be more like a gypsy, not...
I think, you know, for me, it's just the gypsies. I don't think I took it in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
But I could see where you could. So I do think that you just have to... when you dive into these movies, you see there's a lot more than just kind of the happiness that we see every day that you think of with Disney. There are some very dark sides to that.
Yeah, so definitely just making that distinction from secular music and non-secular music, it's kind of like you basically have freedom of choice on what you want to do with your life. So it's not saying like this is wrong or like that is correct. So that's why I kind of wanted to bring that to mind, and it kind of goes along with ethnocentrism and just being able to understand different cultures.
Right.
And I'm just glad that Disney decided to have a black princess.
Yeah, really. Yeah. I mean, when we just saw, you know, we saw
Moana.
Coco. Yeah. Coco now, kind of with going into the Hispanic route there. So I think they are really making this a multicultural experience, because they're realizing that so many children have different experiences, and even family, you know, different families. If you think of the TV show Modern Family, but there's so many different kinds of families. It's not just we could do a whole show on Disney families, because they usually don't have a mom. We usually see one of the parents dies in a Disney movie. I know that's well known.
Yeah, in Frozen, both Elsa and Anna's parents, they die at sea. And just even from that kind of just goes into more Elsa's fear. She's afraid that if someone were to talk to her, she's going to just explode.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
like they become an icicle. So you don't want to mess with Elsa.
It's a cold life.
Would you say that Elsa is a villain or not?
Yeah, I would say Elsa's a villain, kind of like the Beast is a villain. I would compare the two of them, because, you know, Gaston ends up being the bad guy in that movie, but Elsa, you know, she feels like the outcast. She doesn't know how to handle her power, and I think she feels guilty, and so she ends up lashing out. But it's not from a place of being evil, and I think that's the difference. You know, she's crying. She's kind of reaching out for help. She wants to be understood, and I think that's important.
Yeah, just wrapping up here, but we had like a few minutes left. Esmeralda, she sings the song called God Helps the Outcast. From her point of view, she seems more like passive aggressive. It doesn't look like she wants to kind of start a fight, but at the same time, she really doesn't like how Judge Frollo treats, an individual who maybe might be disformed, Quasimodo, because he didn't look like everybody else. So he kind of, takes him in after his mom ends up falling onto the concrete and raises him, but kind of doesn't let him hang around people, and he ends up befriending gargoyles, and it's kind of lonely. Yeah.
And I think that's a common theme with all of these. You have a character that feels like an outcast, that feels different, and is looking for some kind of acceptance, because, that's a psychological point. All of us are seeking some kind of, acceptance in some way. And so all these characters go through that, and then some lash out and are considered evil when you, the audience, know, they're not that bad. But they're trying to say, hey, I'm just different, and what's wrong with that? And I think that's just as relevant today as when, these movies came out.
Yeah, I definitely think that Quasimodo might have had an Electra complex for Esmeralda. Yeah, right. He didn't have his mom around him. And she was like the first thing that came in and, gave that nurturing side and stuff and kept telling him that everything's going to be okay. So he ended up falling in love with her.
Right.
Yeah, and from going through the lifespan from death until birth and reverse happens all the time, just understanding the past, the present, and the future from Dr. Facilier's point of view, from The Princess and the Frog, does Disney do a good job in order to kind of just shed light on certain issues just for kids to understand and for parents to talk about with their kids and like open discussions?
I think so, absolutely. When I'm thinking about the Pixar movie Inside Out, which has so many psychological principles, and that movie, sadness and anger, and I think that's a great example of them reaching out to parents about how to talk to kids about difficult topics. So I don't think Disney shies away from trying to send a message or push a moral. And you're going to have good movies and bad movies and good moments and bad moments and scary moments. And so I think that comes down to parenting. But I think overall these movies do try to send a moral to kids and to get parents to think about what they're talking to their kids about.
So from our discussion today, how do you think that this can probably help you with your work at Spectrum News and improving as a news anchor?
Well, it's all communication based, mm-hmm. which I love. And I think the one thing I've learned since I've been doing this, this is a communication field, and sometimes, I'll be honest, those of us that are in the field forget to communicate as well as we could. And so I think no matter what, this all comes down to talking to kids, make sure that there's that bridge, that gap between parents and children. And a lot of the stories I do affect families and the decisions that they make. So it's important to talk about issues and the role that the media plays in kids' lives. You may have children, like we said, that are more mature, others that mature at a later age. And just with news stories, when I think about the work that I do, we have to keep in mind who's watching this and what they may get out of it. And something that, that you may not, as an adult, you may not think is that jarring or that disturbing could be troublesome for a child.
Yeah, definitely. I do think there should be more like news stories that are kind of more so for kids. Because even today there was a news story about emerging adulthood, and it's now the age of 30.
Emerging adulthood?
Yeah, age 30 now.
Now that people actually feel like adults?
Is that cognitively everything and all.
Yeah, it's interesting. I can believe that.
Yeah, so definitely be sure to stay tuned for a future episode of FearCast. I will be having Dr. Raymond Lim as a guest, and we're going to be talking about robots and psychology. This is Spencer Fuller, your host of FearCast for KPC Radio. The show is live on air Wednesdays at 3 o'clock. Thank you so much, Ariel, for joining me today.
Thank you, Spencer.